You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast. From the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, the museum brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence.
So we're joined today by Brian Gibson, who is a diplomatic historian focusing on the Middle East. He's an adjunct lecturer for the State Department's Foreign Service Institute and an instructor on sectarian divide in the Middle East in the Sunni versus Shia. He's also an adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins University's Krieger School of Arts and Sciences here in Washington, D.C., where he's the instructor for two MA-level courses, Politics and Security in the Middle East and Global Security Studies. He holds a PhD in International History from the London School of Economics and Political Science in the U.K., and he's the author of Covert Relationship, American Foreign Policy Intelligence in the Iran-Iraq War, 1980-1988, and co-editor of the Iran-Iraq War, New International Perspectives. He's also the author of a new book, Sold Out, U.S. Foreign Policy, Iraq, the Kurds, and the Cold War. Brian, thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at SpyCast.
Thanks for having me.
So the reason your book really jumped out to me is I think that there's a lot of ignorance out there. And you don't use that word to be mean. I mean, a lot of people look at America's role or America's relationship with Iraq as something in the last 15 years,
you know, I mean, post-1990s.
Yeah, I mean, for my generation, I'm a little bit older. You know, Desert Storm is really kind of the first indication. I mean, I remember a little bit about the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s, but I think very few people understand how far back this goes. And that's why this book was really interested to me, because it goes back to the very end of World War II. I mean, and I think that even if people are surprised, they may not be surprised by the reasons that Iraq played a significant role. The Soviet threat, oil, a lot of the same things that, you know, we pay attention to today when it comes to Middle East, except for the Soviets.
Yeah.
And one thing that was really interesting to me, and you can talk a little bit about this, is this perception that people don't necessarily understand today, but this zero-sum idea of the Cold War, where an area of the world wouldn't be considered necessarily a strategic American interest, except for the fact that the Soviets considered it a strategic interest. Can you talk a little bit about that, how that applies to Iraq and the Cold War?
Well, when the Cold War first started in the 1940s and into the 1950s, and they started establishing their containment, where they would gather up an alliance of states that surrounded the Soviet Union, and Iraq played a key part of that because they were in the string called the Northern Tier that ran from Turkey through Iraq and into Iran and then Pakistan. And the Baghdad Pact is named after this alliance, and Britain was involved as well, and the United States played a kind of secondary role to it. But the big fear with Iraq, not just because it had a lot of oil, was that it was really close to the Soviet Union. It was just a really quick hop over the Zagros Mountains that run between Turkey and Iran, and you're there. And then it's flat desert after that, so the U.S. looked at their oil assets, which were really important in Saudi Arabia, where they had a very long relationship with them. And you look at Iraq, and you can imagine that if you're actually looking at a map and you see these mountains, it's not that hard to get across them if you're airlifting or whatnot.
Right. I think people look at Iran today and don't quite understand the relationship pre-1979, where Iran was a staunch American ally.
Very close, yeah.
And Iran and Turkey of course, is was then and is still part of NATO. Those are the two nations that border the Soviet Union directly. Mm-hmm. And if you could circumvent that barrier by getting into
leapfrogging.
Yeah. That would be really problematic. I mean, it's the same reason we were worried about Saddam Hussein going into Kuwait, was that it was a straight highway to American and British oil.
Yeah, very close.
So I think people might also not be surprised to learn that U.S. interventionism during this time is really what contributed to Iraq's economic and political destabilization, as it still does.
Absolutely.
You know, there's a long history of us meddling.
Yep.
And again, this is not some liberal philosophy of, you know, we shouldn't be interventionist. There's pretty staunch evidence that you provide in your book that we really mess things up.
Yeah, that's kind of the one of the big points that I drove home. And this is just the idea that interventions during the Cold War have had a destabilizing effect. Now, that draws on Arne Westad's famous book, The Global Cold War. He was one of my colleagues at the LSE, and I became very close with him. And when I was looking at Iraq as a case study for his argument, which he didn't really discuss much in his book, but I couldn't think of a better example of where these interventions did help pave the way for the rise of Saddam Hussein, whether intentionally or not.
Right.
I'm more on the not intentional side. Well,
you would think we would not do that on purpose. Why it's interesting to me is that a lot of the interventionism we're talking about was centered around CIA-led covert action.
Yeah.
And that's not just for one administration. That goes from the beginning all the way through later on. So let's break this down a little bit. And let's start with the Eisenhower administration, because that's kind of what you do in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Eisenhower worked, or wanted to at least, work with Nasser.
Yes.
And why that's really interesting to me, and it should be to others, is that our main allies in the region, if you talk about the British and the Israelis, mm-hmm. did not want to work with Nasser. In fact, they even saw communism as less of a problem than Nasser was. This is a real breakaway. I mean, you look at what we might consider to be this like strong Western bloc, especially in the 1950s, against communism in the Soviet Union. But this is an instance where that went out the window.
Yeah. The special relationships.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, where we, I mean, it's not hard to look at Suez in 56, but this is beyond that. This is the idea that just didn't trust Nasser.
Well, and when you look at 56 was such, and this is when the Suez crisis happened, where the United States got kind of blindsided by the Israelis, the French, and the British, who all concocted this kind of scheme to regain British control over Egypt. And that was a big break with the Eisenhower administration, because they were A, left in the dark, and B, furious that this intervention that they did and didn't consult the Americans with happened at the exact same time as the Hungarian uprising, which the U.S. wanted the international media to focus on that, not some colonial action, police action against Nasser. But what's so surprising was the Americans were really upset with Nasser because he went to the Czechs to purchase weapons after they had rebuffed them. So the Americans were really kind of tenuous with Nasser. And that's why when you look at this kind of post-Iraq revolution in 58, this sudden collusion between the Americans and the Egyptians, that's quite striking. There's not a lot of discussion about this in other sources that I've looked at. And so this collusion really stood out as something that was quite fascinating, because the British, who were the dominant power, they were called the regional policemen, or this was their part of their sphere of influence. When you're looking at the British wanted Nasser as far away from the Persian Gulf oil as possible, and actively worked with the Iraqi, the new Iraqi president after the revolution, Abdel Karim Qasim. They actually secretly supported him, but the Americans weren't sure about Qasim, because he was deemed pro-communist.
Right.
So you've got this really kind of, the special relationship didn't quite add up when it came to this question in the region.
And you bring up an interesting point. I mean, this is, again, might be very difficult for some of the younger listeners to understand. This is a time when the United States was very willing to let Britain take the lead in the Middle East. They hadn't left yet. They were still considered kind of the lead country when dealing with this. The Americans were
kind of their sphere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The flirtation with Nasser certainly will come to be important later on.
Yeah.
But you brought up Qasim, because you look at the JFK administration, because they were much more overt about being covert.
Yes.
About using the CIA to look into potential ways to overthrow Kassim after he started thinking about nationalizing U.S. oil companies and movements toward...
He nationalized their the area that they can search for oil, which any place that they hadn't actually searched yet, the Iraqi government took back the right to own that, which was something like 98% of all Iraqi territory.
Right. In the book, I laughed when I read that. I was just like, and they were like, you can have everything else. I was like, thanks.
Yeah.
And then you even get to the Nixon administration, where I'm skipping Johnson, but we'll get, this is just a brief overview, where the Kurds really come into play here. Because under Kissinger, who is both Nixon's Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, this real alliance, for lack of, this is the kind of the sold out part of your title of your book, this at least tentative alliance between the Americans and the Kurds really starts to play out as Iraq gets closer to the Soviet Union. And again, anyone who knows Desert Storm or the war in 03, Iraq had all Soviet-made equipment, T-55, T-72s, MiG aircraft. This is where that starts. This is where that buying begins. And so Nixon and Kissinger kind of sidle up to the Kurdish groups. And this is where this real interesting relationship begins.
This is when it gets very complicated and very bifurcated, where one side of the government is acting as if everything's normal, and then the secret side of the American government is doing anything but normal things.
Well, and that's really interesting to me that the JFK side, he starts this dual track policy that you're talking about here, where there's overt State Department engagement with the Iraqi government, but at the same time, behind their back, there's this covert attempt by the CIA to find ways to overthrow the government. This is really, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, where we see the Baathists for the first time and during JFK's administration.
Well, they were around, they'd been around for quite some time. In 1959, Saddam Hussein, who's a Baathist, probably the most famous Baathist ever, he tried to kill Qasem. And that was part of a plot to unseat him, which I'm fairly certain, at least from my research, that Nasser was actually behind this. The CIA are accused of being involved, but I've never seen any like smoking gun document that suggests that they were actually the ones who were kind of the puppet masters pulling the strings.
And the CIA gets blamed for just about everything that people want to blame them for during that time.
Yeah, and in the Middle East, they're everything from a mouse farting is blamed on the CIA. I interviewed a Canadian intelligence officer who was the charge d'affaires in Baghdad once, and he's like, the one thing that you'll know the more and more you get involved in the intelligence field is that the CIA, while they've got this amazing reputation, they are not that good.
If the CIA was involved in everything we've been blamed for, they've been blamed for being involved in, there'd be no real problems in the world if they were that powerful.
If they were that good at what they did, everything would be peachy.
There's a really interesting personality here that I think we need to talk about before we move on, and that's Mullah Mustafa Barzani.
Yes.
Who is
legendary.
He is the head of the Kurdish leader, who had been exiled to the Soviet Union in 1946, I believe. Yeah. And then he comes back. But because of his time in the Soviet Union, we had a weird, interesting perception of him. We couldn't get beyond, at least for a while.
Yeah, he was known as the Red Mullah.
Right, the idea that he's a Soviet puppet.
Yeah.
But you argue in the book that he really came back from the Soviet Union, like so many others do, jaded about socialism, untrusting of Moscow's intentions. Is this a real missed opportunity, the United States, to work with somebody who wasn't going to become another Mao or another Ho Chi Minh or somebody that we, almost another Tito in this case.
I was actually just going to say, he reminds me of Tito. This was absolutely a missed opportunity. And the worst part was that the main reason why it was missed was because people at the State Department were like, we need to focus on improving relations with Iraq, not with this rebel leader up in the mountains who lived in the Soviet Union. So they assumed that he was a communist, but he's not. He was a kind of conservative tribal leader. And so it took a lot of arm twisting. I think it was in 1962. No, it was actually 1963 when someone was like, we actually need to kind of talk to him. Mm-hmm. We need to get a really good sense because we've got these journalists who are going there and are interviewing him. And they're like, he's not a communist. At least nothing about him comes across as that.
Right.
That was in 62. But then by 63, when the Ba'ath Party was in power and it was kind of the Cold War balance in Iraq had actually shifted in America's favor, suddenly they were like, we need to actually talk to the Kurds because this war between the central government and the Kurds is destabilizing the country, which is giving the Soviet Union opportunities to kind of meddle in their affairs. And to the point where they tried to launch coups, they tried to... There were a ton of things in 63 that happened that I've never seen anywhere else other than in my own research.
Well, what's interesting is you're right, when the Ba'ath take control, the roles are somewhat reversed, like you just talked about. This idea that now the Soviet Union is trying to wage a covert war against the government. And that really kind of forces the U.S. to get involved. You wrote that in 1961, there was a Kurdish uprising, not by Barzani, but Barzani kind of gets pulled into it.
Yeah.
And the Soviet Union actually has their hands in this a little bit, where...
Well, at least there's allegations.
Allegations to try to distract from Berlin.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work because JFK doesn't really care.
Yeah.
But by the time the Soviets, talk about this zero sum idea, by the time the Soviets are now waging a covert war against the government, it kind of forces the United States to get involved. And you even talk about that they're talking again about the CIA being involved in other things, that when the Ba'ath take control, they go and kill a bunch of the communists.
Yes.
And they have this list.
Yeah,
that the CIA is accused of providing.
Which is something that comes up all the time. This is one of those kind of canards from about Iraq and CIA that pop up in news articles, like contemporary news articles today. They're just like, yeah, the CIA did this and the CIA did that. And Iraqis firmly believe this. I've met with Iraqi parliamentarians and Kurds that are like, oh, well, you know the CIA was behind this. But when you look at the actual evidence, and the lists is one of the more interesting ones, because, yeah, I confirmed that the lists existed, but the question that I raised was, why would the Ba'ath Party need lists of communists when just, like, a year earlier, the communists were out in the public? They could sit there and mark down the names of who these guys... They didn't need the CIA to be like, hey, these people are communists. Right. It's like, they already knew who these people were because they're their enemies.
Right. I mean, this is the second time the Ba'ath have come into power, right? Or is this the first time?
This is the first time.
Okay, so, but they had been plotting.
Yeah.
To, you know, so they knew who the bad guys were without the CIA.
That's like, would be like today, people being like, here's a list of Republicans. Yeah. When, like after the end of the George Bush administration, someone handing, like, some enemies of the Republican Party a list of the Republicans. It's like, no, you know who they are because they're public officials. And that's it's kind of ludicrous when you really get into it and actually look at, into the evidence, because I mean, the story doesn't check out.
Before we move into hunkering down a little bit more on the Kurds, I want to take a step back, because the Kurds, I think, are some of the most misunderstood groups.
Absolutely.
The Peshmerga, the Kurds. You hear about them all the time today because they are one of the strongest forces going up against ISIS and up against some of these governments. They're not Arab. They're not Muslim.
Nope. They are Muslim.
Oh, some of them are. Some of them are.
They're more or less Sunnis.
Okay.
But the thing is that they're, because they've been so isolated from the rest of Iraq, they're not like Saddam Sunnis.
Right, okay.
Because they hated Saddam, and a lot of them are quite secular.
Right.
But again, you can be a secular Sunni. Saddam Hussein was a secular Sunni.
Right.
So
they're not fundamentalists. Let me put that out there. Yeah, okay.
No.
So
I mean, there's certainly like fringe elements of any population that are fundamentalists, but they are very unified, even though elements of them hate each other.
Right. Well, and I think that's one of the questions that people ask me and people want to know about, because there is this back and forth about they're the one group fighting ISIS. Now, why not help them? Why not supply them with more? And the answer usually is, there are minorities in Turkey and in Iran and places that, especially Turkey, that we
Turkey's
have close alliances with, that don't like the Kurds very much, with the PKK and other groups that, sure, they're helping us fight ISIS and others, but an ally would be destabilizing to a very key NATO ally in the region.
Yeah. I mean, Turkey wants nothing to do with the Kurds. They will trade with the Kurdish regional government. They're happy to buy their oil. But the thing is they have this really... They didn't even call them Kurds up until, I think, 2008. Before that, they were known as Mountain Turks. So they denied the existence of this ethnic minority, which is a large part of Turkish population. It was illegal to speak the Kurdish language. These restrictions have been lifted, but only recently, like in the last 10 years. So they have this real big problem with the idea of an independent Kurdistan, because if Kurdistan as a country, if you look at a map of where the Kurds live in the Middle East, it's a huge area.
Right.
Turkey would lose the kind of the eastern half of their country. Iraq would lose the northern part of it. Iran would lose a section of its western part. But yeah, it's a large amount of square miles that they live in, and it straddles four countries really, because there's also Kurds in Syria. So it's really complicated. But this is like a 4,000 year old like group of people who are distinct, ethnically different from Turks, from Persians, from Arabs. And like Saladin, one of the most famous Middle Eastern like historical figures, he's a Kurd.
Oh, I had no idea. That's interesting. And that's Saladin, what, the Third Crusade against Richard the Lionhearted.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going back to
Richard the Lionhearted.
Right, I'm going back to like undergrad history, but yeah. I remember how important he was. I mean, this is not within the auspices of your book, but the reason we, let's use the word sellout, the reason that we abandoned the Kurds after Desert Storm is this the same reason that we're talking about now? Because didn't George H.W. Bush promise he would help them if they rose up against Saddam Hussein? And then when they did...
And got crushed.
We said, sorry, guys, you're on your own.
Well, they said sorry, and then they followed it up with very quickly Operation Provide Comfort, because they felt really bad. Yeah. But, I mean, this is one of those, like, the Kurds have a long memory, and they look at these events, and they look at the events in 75, where the U.S., quote-unquote, sold them out. And then they look at 1991, where they got abandoned again. And so there's, for a group of people who really like the United States, there's a lot of reasons for them to be a little uncomfortable with this relationship that they're developing now. But now is kind of their moment in the sun. People now, like walking down the street, have heard of the Kurds. Whereas before that, they might remember, oh, didn't they get gassed at Halabja in 1988? But that would be the extent of it.
Right.
People don't know their history. And that is one of the things that kind of attracted me to them in the beginning is when I did a lot of work on the Iran-Iraq war, and of course you look at what's happening, you look at what happened at Halabja, but then for me I kind of did a George Lucas style where I wrote the second part first and then went back to the beginning, because I was like, I need to know the context of what like better of what led to my first book. And that's when I started digging into this, and that was my PhD topic. And as you get more and more into it, it's a kind of a harrowing tale that, like, the history writes itself. It ends in tragedy.
Right.
But it's a matter, what a lot of people didn't get and don't understand is the context in which the tragedy unfolded. Because you look at these, there's newspaper articles that come up every once in a while that mention the sellout in 1975. And when you dig through what they're saying, it's not right. It's not based on fact. It's actually based on a leaked congressional report that was leaked to the press in 1976.
Well, let's work our way up to that sellout. Yeah, let's hop back to the LBJ administration, because you can go back and forth all we want about how good of a president he was, but Vietnam will always kind of be his legacy.
Yeah.
And so he had to take a different tactic when dealing with this area of the world, because he was so focused on Vietnam.
Well, and domestic reform
from the Great Society, everything else.
Yeah.
And so you talk about him building what he called the twin pillars.
Mm-hmm.
And this is building up Iran and the Saudi Arabian government. Is this why you get the current strength of Saudi Arabia? Is this why the Americans and Saudis are, I mean, obviously it's oil.
Yeah.
But is this where this tight relationship really comes into play during the Johnson administration?
Yeah, well, what it really boils down to was Britain's decision in 1968 to announce its withdrawal of all of its military forces east of Suez, which included the Persian Gulf. Now, prior to that, Britain had been the kind of regional power. They dominated, they provided security for everyone. And a lot of these states were in a kind of semi-colonial state. And Britain's withdrawal in 1968 is kind of crucial, because what was going on in 1968? Well, Vietnam was very much escalated, right. And the United States were incapable of taking over that role. They even offered to just pay for Britain to stay. But the British couldn't sell that to their public.
So I remember, right, you talk about them withdrawing like right around the Tet Offensive. I mean, right in the beginning of 68.
I think it was like a couple days later, maybe 2 weeks later, the Tet Offensive began. Because that was end of January 1968. Right. And it was like January 15th when they announced it, but they told the Americans like 5 days before then. And which was a great, great, great interaction between Rusk and George Brown, where he slammed his hands on the table and was like, "God damn it, like Britain, like you're Britain, yeah. like you're supposed to be like a world power, and you're acting so cowardly." But it was because the Americans were really upset because they weren't able to fill in that role, and that was what led to the Twin Pillars. But yeah, I mean, the decision to build up Iran and Saudi Arabia have long-term consequences, one of which being the Shah of Iran's kind of spending spree,
right,
which helped bankrupt his government and then contributed to the overthrow of his government about a decade later. And then with Saudi Arabia, this was when Iran fell in 1979, there was only one pillar left. And so that meant that they had to focus all their efforts on building up, the Saudis. And that, of course, has long-term consequences, because now the United States is in this, like, oil relationship on the one hand and a security relationship on the other. And the Saudis know this and leverage it against the United States a lot.
So right before Nixon took over, the Baaths took over again.
Yes.
Which, you know, there's a lot of back and forth in this book between... Mm-hmm. Who's in charge? But this is really the last one of those, because the Baaths stay in power
until 2003.
Right, until 2003. And yes, it's not Saddam Hussein the whole time, but it's him or his uncle or somebody else. What's interesting to me is that the Nixon administration would later really start to care about the Middle East. But at first, they didn't as much, perhaps. Mm-hmm. I mean, they kind of implement the Nixon doctrine as they try to do around the world. They kind of, in Vietnam, the Vietnamization. Yeah. You know, do you see that same thing in the Middle East?
Yeah. Well, the way it was described in documents was that they farmed out their foreign policy to the State Department and to regional desks, because Nixon believed that if you got entangled in these small little third world conflicts, you're going to lose sight of the bigger picture, which to him was the battle with the Soviet Union, and he wanted to kind of put the Soviets on their knees. And he did that through the opening to China and then through the SALT engagement, and which created detente. And it was really interesting to see how important the Persian Gulf was for the Johnson administration and how little it mattered immediately afterwards. Mm-hmm. And even one of the first crises of the Nixon administration was Iraq hanging, I think it was like 9 Jews publicly, which led to Israel launching attacks on Iraqi forces in Jordan. And it was just this really kind of dangerous situation that could escalate quite quickly. And after that, they just didn't really touch on the subject for quite some time. And so it's all State Department.
Right.
But then, of course, after Kissinger takes over the State Department, then it starts to become a lot more important.
And that's where you start seeing Kissinger working directly with the Kurds and against...
It was a little before then, because the reason why the Kurds were kind of brought to the attention of the White House was because in 1972, in late 1971 through to April 1972, the Iraqis moved very close to the Soviets very quickly, signed a treaty of friendship and cooperation, allowed the Soviets to kind of build up one of their big oil fields in the south, and you just started to see regional leaders like the Shah or the Israelis or the Jordanians and even the Saudis approaching the Nixon administration saying, "Hey, you need to do something about Iraq. We're growing really concerned about this. And your best bet is to work with the Israelis and the Iranians to support the Kurds, because they'd been supporting them since the, like, 1963.
Right.
So it seemed like a logical place for them to go with their operations and whatnot.
And covert action seems to be the natural choice here, especially because the person who had just been replaced at CIA ends up as the ambassador in the region, essentially being in charge, and this is Richard Helms.
Yeah, which was a demotion.
Right, yeah. But it's handy to have somebody that understands covert action now, yeah, kind of at State Department, looking at the entirety of the Middle East and really understanding, yeah, how the CIA can be used as a tool there.
And Helms knew the Shah from his role as, you know, being one of the senior intelligence official in the U.S., but also they went to the same school when they were kids. They didn't go at the same time, but they lived in the same place, and so right, they could familiarize themselves through that. And, yeah, that was a very interesting move on the Nixon administration's part. And it was because Helms refused to cover up Watergate. That was why he got demoted, and that's why he wasn't... Nixon never trusted the CIA from the whole the missile gap thing,
right,
during his first run for presidency. And so he hated the CIA, and I found out, I'm not sure if I even include this in the book or not, but Helms wasn't even allowed in on cabinet meetings for the first year of Nixon's presidency, which is very peculiar.
Right.
They would call him in to do the briefing, and then he would be kicked out of the room. And that shocked me, because this is a senior official, but eventually cabinet officers were like, you've got to have the director of the CIA here. Like... you can't just cut him out. He needs to give his take and his assessment on a lot of really big issues, right, that we're dealing with. And so eventually Nixon relinquished his banishment, I guess.
Well, I mean, especially with Nixon being the foreign policy president that he was.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not Johnson has, you know, the full attention on domestic policy or Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Nixon is known for his foreign policy.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, I mean, he was... I find Nixon a fascinating character because I'm a foreign policy guy.
Yeah.
And from that perspective, he's quite incredible. But when you look at him as a person, you're like, he is,
yeah,
sleazy. But not in like the LBJ type sleaze or the JFK type sleaze. He was just like, well, a Tricky Dick,
right,
was like his nickname. And but he would do anything to win. And that's why he... is who he is, and why he, like, the 72 election was one of the greatest electoral victories of all time. And so I find him such a fascinating person. But yeah, he was the foreign policy president. He was very much kept away from domestic policy and focused on the bigger picture of the competition with the Soviet Union. And this operation to help the Kurds was all part of that. It's all interlinked.
Right.
As part of this geopolitical competition.
Maybe I'm overreading this, but it almost read like the operation with the Kurds was almost like a dress rehearsal for what comes later in Afghanistan. I mean, it's not directly against, yeah, the Soviet military, but Kissinger really wanted the Soviet Union to bleed, at least economically.
Yeah.
Right? This to become like just a bottomless pit of them just throwing economic aid, yeah, after Iraq, one after the, yeah, other.
Which was exactly what I think he said this in his memoirs. He was like, the purpose of the operation was to teach the Soviets a lesson that if they wanted to enter in the Middle East, it wasn't going to be cheap. And which was precisely what ended up happening. Their relationship with Iraq was never particularly, yeah, good. And the Iraqis kept the Soviets at arm's length, too. And that existed all the way up through the 1980s. They were very much people, like Saddam was someone who... he didn't need someone else to help him make a decision. He made the decisions himself. And the Soviets could say whatever they wanted. And the Iraqis persecuted against communists plenty of times during Saddam's time in power. So, at which drove the Soviet Union nuts, because they're like, you're supposed to be our ally, but,
right,
you're killing communists. And he's like, I'll kill anyone who, yeah, who potentially poses a threat to my control of the country. And...
well, and you don't cover this because you stop your book in 75, but you obviously are an expert on the Iran-Iraq war side of it, and it's the you know, delve into the idea of the covert aid to both sides.
Oh, that's
during this time. We can take a couple minutes for our listeners who don't know I know you could probably talk about that for hours.
Yeah.
Well, but kind of how this relationship's built upon during the 1980s.
Well, the really peculiar thing is, so after the Kurdish operation came to an end in 75, members of Congress leaked this report that exposed the Nixon administration's involvement with the Kurds.
And this is the Pike Committee report,
This is the Pike Committee report, which I've been trying desperately to get my hands on a copy. If someone knows how to get me one, like not the one that was published, but an actual copy, because there's one page missing and it deals with my subject. But what's interesting about the Pike Committee report and the leaking of it was the Iraqis were like, well, now we know for a fact that you were helping the Kurds. And you always denied it, but now it's a fact. Like, this is a public secret. And Kissinger's response to that was, well, we thought you were close to the Soviets at the time, which I thought was amazing. But what's really interesting is then fast forward 4 years, and the Iranian Revolution has happened. And again, that kind of regional balance of power just changes overnight. Right. A pro-American monarchy, the Shah, is overthrown overnight, and a radical fundamentalist government comes into power who hates the United States. That is one of the central components of their ideology, is anti-Americanism. And so suddenly Saddam doesn't look so bad, especially because Iraq and Iran are regional rivals historically. And so, also remember, Saddam is a Sunni secular person, whereas now Iran is a Shia fundamentalist
theocracy.
And who hates the United States. So the United States very quickly were like, well, Iraq doesn't look so bad, especially because the Kuwaitis, the Saudis, and the Jordanians and the Egyptians, all the Sunnis kind of backed Iraq in this war. And the United States very quickly, at first they didn't really care. They were happy to see Iran and Iraq bleed each other dry. But in 1971 into 1972, Iran reversed Iraq's territorial gains to the point where they were at the border. Mm-hmm. And in June 1972, the Reagan administration was faced with a very, very, very challenging situation where if Iran broke through at Basra, that would put them within a couple several dozen kilometers or miles from, I'm Canadian, so several dozen miles from Kuwait and Kuwait's oil wealth. And then just beyond that are where the main Saudi oil fields are. So the real fear was that if they could smash through the Iraqi defenses, Kuwait and Saudi Arabia's oil fields would be within striking distance, like easy striking distance. They could get there in a day or two. And the idea of Iran then controlling not just Iran's own oil well, but Iraq's southern oil fields, Kuwait's oil fields, and the Saudis, that would put them in control of something like 60 to 70% of the world's oil supply. And to the United States and to Western Europeans and to pretty much everyone, this couldn't happen. They had to do everything in their might to prevent Iran from gaining control of this. So what they opted to do was they sent, Tom Tweten, who's a CIA, he was in the Near East Bureau, and they sent him to Baghdad with these very precise drawings of where Iranian forces were laid out, and gave them suggestions on where they should put their troops to kind of prevent a breakthrough. And this established kind of they couldn't give the actual satellite because those were highly classified, and so they put a blank sheet of paper and got an artist to come in and to trace the whole thing out so that they could be like, oh, okay, we know exactly what you're talking about. And then so for the much of the rest of the war until the exposure of the Iran-Contra scandal and that was in 1986, mm-hmm. Up to that point, this was the basis of the relationship. A lot of people talk about the United States giving weapons to Iraq. I couldn't find a lot of evidence that showed that American weapons were being sent to Iraq, mainly because, as we discussed a little while ago, all of Iraq's weaponry are Soviet.
Right, yeah. I mean, the possibility of us giving them captured weapons from the Eastern Bloc.
Yeah.
But in Desert Storm, we didn't run up against any American-made weapons.
No.
You know, it's only now that we're running up against American-made weapons
yeah.
that have been captured from the Iraqi military by ISIS.
Yeah, Mosul.
Yeah. You mentioned the phrase balance of power, and as one diplomatic historian to another, this is certainly a kind of a way that many of us look at the world, certainly during the Cold War, versus this ideological framework. And
yeah.
and the reason I bring that up is there's a surprising lack of discussion of religion in this book. And, yeah. And in one case, I found it very refreshing, but I also found it interesting because we're talking about the Middle East,
yeah.
right? And it might be very surprising also for listeners to understand that these were nations, not just the United States, but these were nations in the Middle East who were doing business with one another and with the West based on realpolitik, based on like this very calculated balance of power philosophy, and not on Shia-Sunni rivalries and not on death to America religion.
Yeah.
And that comes, you know, like you said, in 79.
The Iranian Revolution was what really tipped things over. Because we haven't really talked about Arab nationalism, because during the 50s and 60s, that was the like en vogue like right. ideology in the region. That was what Nasser sort of espoused. But the defeat of Egyptian forces, like the crushing defeat at the hands of the Israelis in
1967,
June 67, that kind of showed the bankruptcy of this idea of Arab nationalism and Arab unity, especially because one of the main reasons why Nasser got whipped so bad in 1967 was because he was fighting a civil war in Yemen. So with this war in Yemen in 1967, Nasser had something like 80,000 troops stationed there at the time of the war. And so the devastating defeat of the Egyptians kind of showed that this ideology of Arab unity and Arab nationalism when Nasser's fighting wars against other Arabs
right.
Is kind of bogus. And at that point, Arab nationalism starts to get shoved aside for political Islam. And you see that through the much more in the 1970s. And, of course, this the Iranian Revolution just shows that, Muslims can take control of a state, can overthrow at seemingly impossible odds a strong dictator like the Shah and then establish an actual Muslim form of government. And so this kind of brings religion up much more into the forefront. And one of the really interesting things, and this kind of goes back to that 1972 offensive when the Iranians were on the gates of Basra, was the Iranians actually assumed that the Shia population of Iraq, which was something like 60%, and who were under the heels of the Sunni minority, and so were the Kurds as well, but the Iranians actually believed that the Shia would rise up against Saddam, and they didn't. So this is kind of a fascinating moment in history where everyone's like, oh, no, what's going to happen if the Shia do this? We're in trouble. Like, this is what kind of helped bring about the giving of the intelligence to the Iraqis. And then the Shia didn't. They actually stood and fought against the Iranians, which kind of reinforced this the Arab versus Persian
right.
dynamic, where religion didn't matter as much to these people. It's only really been since the overthrow of the Ba'athist regime in Iraq in 2003 that this kind of sectarianism that is kind of the dominant thing right now in the Middle East really started to take form. And that was because the balance in the region, the sectarian balance, where the kind of Shia crescent, which runs where this is where the Shias are large populations, which runs from Iran, which is a majority Shia state, through Iraq, which was ruled by a Sunni and now is ruled by the Shia,
right?
But is also a Shia majority state, through to Syria, which has an Alawite government, which are a subsect of Shiism, and then into Lebanon, where you've got Hezbollah, which are the Shia are now a majority there,
right?
So the turning of Iraq from a Sunni state to a Shia state completely altered the kind of sectarian framework of the region. And another aspect of this is the champion of the Shia is Saudi Arabia. Sorry, the champion of the Shia is Iran, and the champions of the Sunni are Saudi Arabia.
Right.
But when you look at the metrics between Saudi Arabia and Iran, Iran is decidedly more powerful. It's got a much larger population. It's got a more sophisticated population. They've got better education. They've got a very strong military that's indigenous, so they don't have to rely on other countries, which is a byproduct of them being abandoned by everyone in the Iran-Iraq war. But then you look at the Saudis, and the Saudis have a very tiny population. They do not have a very sophisticated military. They have not been tested militarily, other than a bit of skirmishing with the in Yemen. They haven't really been tested all that much. But then you, whereas the Iranians fought the Iran-Iraq war for 8 years.
Right.
So what the Saudi strategy seems to be is to kind of invigorate and shift the balance in the region in their favor by playing the sectarian card with Sunnis.
Right.
And playing it as the Iranian Shias are trying to take over, and they're trying to shift, to kind of balance things out a little bit.
You'd mentioned that 79 was kind of the key turning point with the Iranian Revolution. Do the CIA docs demonstrate that? I mean, before 79, do you see any discussion of Shia Sunni religion in CIA analyses and in documents before 79? And do you see a dramatic change after 79? I mean, is that something that is represented in CIA, CIA internal documents?
Yeah. I haven't found a lot, because that's not really something that I've, like, I'm looking at this from kind of a purely foreign policy mm-hmm. point of view, and you do see things here and there. I certainly saw stuff in the early formation of the Iraqi government, because that's the next project I'm working on, where when suddenly they named the cabinet to the monarch, and this is obviously around the 1920s, and they're like, it's all Sunnis. I think the Shia population, which are the majority, might be upset about this, but it's a monarchy, so what are you going to do?
Right.
And the United States did not really have much of a presence in the region at that point. So then when you're looking into the 1950s and 60s, it's mainly about Arab nationalism.
Yeah, so there's just no real discussion about that. Yeah.
It does come up here and there, but not very much. Because the early Ba'ath Party had a lot of Shia in it as well, which a lot of people don't realize, and because they're secular.
Right.
Like, they believe in separation of church and state, and or mosque and state, and so that kind of changes things a bit.
So Dr. Brian Gibson is an author of several books. One of them is Covert Relationship, American Foreign Policy, Intelligence in the Iran-Iraq War, 1980-1988. He's also co-editor of the Iran-Iraq War, New International Perspectives. And finally, the author of a new book, Sold Out, U.S. Foreign Policy, Iraq, the Kurds, and the Cold War. Thank you, Brian, for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to SpyCast. Remember, every Tuesday, we will post a new podcast available from both spymuseum.org and iTunes. If you have any questions or comments about SpyCast, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org or leave a comment or review on our iTunes page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @INTLSpycast. That's @INTLSpycast. Talk to you next week.